Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. In this first part of the show, we'll be looking at the controversy over Columbus. We are now observing the 500th anniversary of the arrival of Columbus in the New World. And it seems that as a society, we have rather mixed feelings about this event. There are some people who truly think that we should be celebrating as we observe the contribution of European culture in building something that was truly new and different, a new American culture, and that probably we all wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the fact that Columbus had come and begun this wave of immigration from the Old World to the New World. There are also some people who say that the result of the Europeans coming to the New World was the destruction of what was already a rich and flourishing culture in the New World, and that in fact what it amounted to was genocide, that there was a purposeful destruction of culture and people here in the New World, and that somehow that echoes through all those 500 years to the present day. We'll be talking about this controversy this morning with Pete Volz. He is an associate professor of history and journalism at Eastern Illinois University. His academic background is in Latin American history, and he teaches courses in American history, Afro-American history, Central American history, U.S.-Latin American relations. He has also been teaching about Columbus. In fact, he developed a course on Columbus, America, and the Indians, which he taught at Parkland College this spring. And I think we had actually been identifying him with Parkland College. That's where the connection is. He is, in fact, as I mentioned, a professor at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. He developed this course for teachers, for anybody who was interested in learning more about Columbus and the coming of the Europeans and this early part of the history of the Americas. Especially, I think he says it's his desire to get past some of the superficial and sensational coverage that we have seen in the media and trying to get into a little bit more depth and develop a little bit better understanding of the impact of Europeans on the New World. So we will look at that this morning, and as always, your comments, questions are welcome. The telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for coming over to talk with us.
Well, good morning, Dave. Glad to be here.
What before we get into particulars, what generally bothers you, or what generally is your sort of feeling about the kind of coverage that the Columbus anniversary has received, sort of the tone of it?
Well, I think the media want to get at the new things. They're always going for the dramatic and the controversial things, and so the media has put a spotlight on the people who have been bashing Columbus, basically, and sometimes the people with the most sensationalist or extreme language and charges are the ones who get the most publicity because it's something new, or we're used to learning about Columbus as a heroic figure in history. It's something new to hear somebody like this bashed all over the place.
Mm-hmm. You think that Columbus has been unfairly criticized? He for whatever has happened after he arrived, good or ill, is he getting too much blame, possibly also too much credit?
Yes, I think most of the reason he's getting so much blame is because he's a symbol. He's a symbol of Europe coming to the New World. He's a symbol of the Spanish coming, even though he was Italian, but he was the leader of the first expedition, which was sponsored by Spain. And so he's a symbol of all of those things, and so if people want to blame those things, they blame him because his name is kind of a magnet that draws attention. Whereas if people stood up and blamed the Spanish for what they did, people wouldn't know what they're talking about because we don't know our Latin American history that well. If they blamed Europeans in general, that would be too unfocused. So they pick out Columbus or Murphy Brown, you might say, and then all of a sudden everybody pays attention because it's somebody that we recognize.
Mm-hmm. Overall, though, doesn't one have to acknowledge the fact that after the Europeans came, there was a precipitous decline in the cultures of the indigenous people here, and that there was, while one can argue about numbers, there was also a fairly dramatic decline in population for some number of reasons, and we may go into that. I mean, if you take the point of view of the people who were here when the Europeans arrived, wouldn't they have to say that was a black day in their history because it meant essentially the end of their culture and their civilizations?
Certainly, they would say it was a disaster, a demographic disaster, a great reduction in their population from anywhere from 75% to 90% of their population. The numbers, of course, are part of the controversy. They're not crucial to the controversy over Columbus, but they are important to it because the bigger the numbers you can inflate, the worse Columbus and the Spanish seem to appear. The original numbers that came out about 50 years ago from Simpson, Bora, and Cook were developed from research in the 1940s, and they said anywhere from 20 million to 100 million Indians were in the New World, and therefore to kill off, say, 80% of them was certainly a great disaster. The more recent numbers from research in the 70s and 80s, which is brought out in the Phillips History of Columbus, puts the figure more accurately at 14 million below the Rio Grande and about 1 to 2 million north of in North America. So we have, say, from 16 to 20 million probably at the most, which is about a fifth then of the people who are going around saying it's 100 million, 120 million. I've heard as high as 150 million Indians were living here. But certainly it was a great demographic disaster to see all these people die, but it was from disease, and certainly the Europeans didn't intentionally do it. They didn't even know they were doing it, of course. So the language becomes a problem here. The word genocide is being thrown about very loosely all over the place. Genocide is a word that came out of the Holocaust, the Nazis killing the Jews in World War II. And the definition, you look it up in Webster's, it is the intentional and systematic killing or extermination of a whole race or nation of people. And, of course, there was nothing intentional about this by Columbus and the Spanish to kill the Indians by disease. There was nothing systematic about it. It wasn't an attempt at extermination. The Spanish, on the contrary, wanted the Indians to live so they could use their labor. Now, it's true there was some extermination policies later on, not by the Spanish, but by the Americans 300 years later in the American West, when we had generals like General Sherman going around saying the only good engine is a dead engine and trying to implement that kind of extermination policy. But that's the only place where the charge of genocide could be made in this controversy. And, of course, it's not being made there at all. It's being made against Columbus and the Spanish, where it's totally inappropriate. It's being used by people who want to make an extreme and emotional argument who just don't know their history and probably don't care. They're so hyped up on their moralistic stand that they don't care about accuracy in history, unfortunately.
See, and I think that for, you know, in defense of those people, I guess what they would say is that the Europeans brought with them the attitude that that whatever they found was there for their use, and that the indigenous people were just kind of in the way. And that they took an attitude toward them that said, well, you know, these people aren't really like us. They're not Christians. They're not white. So maybe they're not even quite human. So we can sort of deal with them in whatever the most expedient way is, whether that's killing them or just saying, well, you folks, you're just going to have to move and get out of the way here because we want this territory here, or looking at them as a source of labor, which in some cases might have amounted literally to slavery. And that is the picture with which we're often presented.
Right, and you're correct in most of that picture. The attitude of probably most of those early Spaniards was a very arrogant attitude, one that was based on greed for the gold or the labor that the Indians could produce for them. They did not intend to kill the Indians, although there were massacres and murders that took place in the process. The process was so bad, of course, that some of the Spaniards, like Bartolomé de las Casas, saw what was going on and went back and persuaded the king and the church in Spain to moderate the policy of colonization in the New World, which they did do then. It's very difficult to do because they're on the other side of the ocean. So there were strong forces battling over this Indian policy. Las Casas persuaded the king and the church that the Indians were human. They were not subhuman. They were not animals. They certainly were not chattel slaves like the Americans treated their slaves up to the Civil War in the South. So the Spanish, 300 years before the United States slavery policy, had a much more enlightened and liberal policy towards both Indians and Africans than the Americans did. I think if there's any repentance to be done this year, it should be more by us Americans in our recent history rather than trying to pin the blame on Columbus and the Spanish like is being done.
Mm-hmm. I think it is sort of an interesting point to note, and I'm not really quite sure how one should think about this, but the fact that the English in North America, and I think perhaps also the Dutch, those people who settled North America, were very eager to paint the Spanish as villains because they thought, well, if we can make the Spanish look bad, then that'll make us look good, or at least we can justify our policies by saying that no matter what we do, the Spanish did worse, and that some of perhaps what we have that has come down through the historical record can be traced to the efforts of the English to make the Spanish look bad. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Spanish were great guys.
Right.
But I suppose that within the mix, we also ought to think of the record of the English and Dutch in North America and have that be part of the picture as well.
Well, you're talking about the Black Legend, which is a great case in history. The Black Legend means the English tried to paint the Spanish as being the cruelest to the Indians in the New World. And their only source of reference for this, of course, is Las Casas' own accounts of how bad the Spanish were treating the Indians that he wrote for the audience in Spain, not for the English. But the English got a hold of it, Hacklight and some of their friends. They published 42 versions of Las Casas' accounts. They dressed them up with all kinds of graphics, terrible pictures of torture and mutilations of Indians. And, of course, that's what we remember. The Newsweek issue that came out last year on Columbus included some of these English propaganda pictures that they drew to go along with Las Casas' account. And, of course, Las Casas himself is not a wholly trustworthy account because Latin American historians know that his account was exaggerated. It was not an accurate rendition of Columbus's log, but rather a summary of it. And Las Casas had his own propaganda axe to grind to persuade the crown and the church that the Indians were human, and so he tended to sensationalize and exaggerate his own accounts. It's very difficult for us to evaluate that without other sources, but that's the judgment of most historians now.
We know a few weeks ago, in fact, we interviewed a fellow who one of Las Casas' accounts has been recently republished in an English translation with a commentary by this fellow. And I think he certainly made the same point that what the Las Casas was trying to do was to paint the absolute worst picture that he possibly could, because it was indeed a polemic. Although reading Las Casas, even if it was only half as bad as he described it, it's still horrific.
Right.
You know, it's sort of difficult to know just how much weight you want to give that, even if it is exaggerated, and we say, well, let's scale it down. It was still indeed very, very bad for those people.
Right, and you also touched on the point of comparative history. In the last 25 years, probably the major interest for American historians has been black history as a result of the Civil Rights Movement. And the key area of interest within black history has been comparative slavery, comparing the different colonies and the way they treated Indians and Africans in slavery. It's been very interesting for American historians to look at this question. And all kinds of exciting conclusions have been drawn about how the different ways the European colonial systems treated the Africans and the Indians. And, of course, the Spanish come off looking as one of the best in their treatment of slavery and especially of the Indians when you compare them with the other cultures. And that point, of course, is getting lost in here. In the whole Columbus debate, again, because we're focusing on him rather than on the whole 500 years of treatment.
Hmm. We have a couple of calls we want to bring into the conversation. Our guest this morning is Pete Vols. He is an associate professor of history and journalism at Eastern Illinois University, and we're talking about the controversy over Columbus. Our guest this morning teaches courses on the history of the Americas, both Latin America and here in the United States.
I've taught those in the past at one time or another. I don't teach those presently.
Okay. Well, I want to make sure that I am correct.
All right.
What I say is correct. So has taught those courses and certainly is an area of interest of his. And if you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of this conversation, we welcome that. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our first caller on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You mentioned the comparative history, and I sort of have a jumbled question here, sort of puts you in the frame of my mind. I wish now that I had taken Spanish, plus Latin, German, and French, you know, when I went through the school system. One reason for shortwave listening, and the next reason is to get a better picture on how things are going to come about in Central and South America, especially in terms of humanitarian values. I recently watched the series, The Buried Mirror, and I also read most of the criticism about it. And I just listened to you for the past 20 minutes, and two questions come out. One, are we or are we going to teach our youth a sort of comparative historical view so that they can line up the cultures themselves and make their value judgments at least from facts? And secondly, where does one go to find these kinds of things that were mentioned, for example, in the Buried Mirror, and, for example, what you've talked about, some of these facts, particularly about the Black Legend. I know about that. But other things, in a sense, where we can move back and sort of have a better feel for it, such as we have when we have all these facts we get about the American Revolution. I remember spending ungodly amount of years on that, and it sort of turned me off to history until I got into college, when I discovered there were other people in the world and they did things a little bit differently, but they still were human. Thanks a lot. Another good show, Dave.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, to take your first question first, are we going to be teaching our youth about comparative history? I don't think so. I think our first step is to teach them about history outside our own country. If you look at most history departments, most of the courses are American history. We seem to be focused on ourselves. We don't teach a whole lot of history anyway. But we need to teach history about Latin America on this question, and of course about the other continents and their history. And just getting to do that would be a monumental achievement in our high schools and colleges, I think. Once we have people who have studied Latin American history, then we can go into the comparative approach, because they've studied American history up here, the British. Do we study any Canadian history with the French? Almost zilch, huh? They study us all over the place, so they know our history. They know they defeated us in the War of 1812. We still teach our kids that we won the War of 1812. See, so there we go. So I don't think we're going to get around to teaching comparative history very much, maybe in the grad school level, but just teaching some Latin American history, some Black history, some Hispanic history, some slavery history. I think those are our first steps to concentrate on now. The second question, where do we go for sources? The library is full of sources on topics like this. If you know what you want to look at, Columbus or Indians or the Black Legend, whatever. There's tons of books coming out on these topics all over the place. I might recommend the textbook we used in our Columbus course, which is a 1992 edition called The Worlds of Christopher Columbus, written by William and Carla Phillips from the University of Minnesota, who are experts on slave history. They've written a history of slavery. And they give a very balanced and rational account of Columbus and all of the Columbus controversies, and they have some of the statistics that I've been quoting here. Another source, a little older source, is Dr. Charles Gibson, who is probably the preeminent expert on the Indians of the colonial period. And he has written two books. One of them we used for a textbook, Spain in America, which is kind of a popular summary of the history of mainly of Mexico and the Spanish colonies during the colonial period. But his masterpiece was called The Aztecs Under Spanish Rule, where he studied what happened to the Aztecs after they were conquered. And he comes to some really challenging conclusions, that the labor systems of the Spanish were very similar to the Indian labor system. So to the common Indian peasant, there was very little change from Aztec to Spanish as far as labor systems go. Now, of course, there was tremendous change for the average peasant Indian as far as as far as slavery, war, and terrorism goes, because the Indians living in subjection under the Aztecs were terrorized that they or their children were going to be part of this human sacrifice and cannibalism that the Aztecs engaged in more than any other peoples in the history of the world. And that's why some historians say that Columbus liberated the Indians of Mexico rather than massacring them or committing genocide or things like that. Dr. Gibson also concluded that the Indians basically survived in Mexico and the Spanish colonies, whereas they didn't basically survive in other places like the United States, that their culture basically survived, that the Spanish and their church nurtured and preserved the Indian community and their culture. And you can go down to Mexico today and find these Indian communities called ejidos, who have been heavily studied by Mexican historians, where much of the Indian culture has been preserved. The Indian language, Nahuatl, has been preserved. And so they've done a much better job of preserving Indian culture and the Indians themselves physically than certainly here what we have done in the United States.
We are about at our midpoint. We need to take a moment to talk about upcoming programs, and then we have other callers that we will talk with. Our guest this morning, Pete Vols, is an associate professor of history and journalism at Eastern Illinois University. We're talking about Christopher Columbus and the impact of Europeans on the New World. Well, we get back to the phones here. We have a couple of callers waiting, and our next person is on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that there's a problem with vilifying Columbus that you haven't mentioned yet. Now, David, you know that I would never criticize our fine, upstanding media elite when, you know, they work so hard to enforce political correctness so that the rest of us don't have to think. But there's still a problem, and the problem is that we have some cities named after Columbus, and we can't really vilify Columbus properly and still name our cities after him. You know, we got to... Just to the east of my city of Bloomington, Indiana, there's a city named Columbus, Indiana. There's Columbus, Ohio, Columbus, Georgia. And the capital of our nation is the District of Columbia. And that's really a problem because if Columbus is denounced. But now, I've also read recently that the Vikings are in. They're no longer marauding, bloodthirsty murderers. Now they're gentlemen seafarers. So it seems to me the solution to the problem is to name these cities, which are now named Columbus, call them Viking. And we could call our District of Columbia, we could call Viking District, VD. Then we can, instead of saying Washington, D.C., we would say Washington, VD. And I just thought that at least that's worth considering, and, you know, so that the media elite will have something to chew.
Uh-huh. Okay. You have some thoughts about that?
Is there a question in there someplace?
just a little bit of commentary. That's fine. Shall we go on to another caller? Or you want
well,
to say something about that?
I would like to say something about the good old Vikings. The Vikings under Bjarni and Leif Erikson, who came over around the year 1000, just before that, were Christians, and so they weren't the old bloodthirsty Vikings anymore, and they came over here to find grapes and to find places to fish and maybe to colonize and settle. And they were unfortunately met by some rather fierce Indians who shot one of their leaders in the back and attacked the others and chased them off, and that's why they never came back, because they thought the place was a little too fierce for them to try to colonize. And so the Vikings have improved their picture a lot from the old Norse raiders.
On to another caller, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. The previous caller, that's one of the funniest things I think he said. I was breaking up here on the phone. I don't know what it means, but it's pretty funny. Hey, listen, I have a couple things I'd like to ask your guest. Mr. Vols, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I've ever since this Columbus controversy's come up, I sit around and I think about things all day long because I don't have anything better to do.
Good habit.
But anyway, what's occurred to me is this. This is my take on all this, and I'd like to hear your response, and I have a couple other quick questions. It seems to me that what really happened was simply a continuation of the process by which the world has been evolving since I can remember, in history, since everything I've learned, it's basically a conquest occurred. Basically, North America, the current United States was conquered by the Europeans, and the reason it wasn't as formal as some other invasions is, my guess is, because what you said, that there simply weren't very many Indians here. It was easily sort of handled ad hoc, but I view it as, basically the Europeans won and the Indians lost. In that context, of course, you know, we can all have sympathy for various things as they are today. But in that context, it seems not. When the Normans invaded England in 1066, do the Saxons still, hate the Normans? You see where I'm coming with this?
Right, right. You're giving a context to it, a historical context, which is very good to do, and which the Columbus bashers don't do.
Right. You know, the other thing, kind of a humorous thing, I was sitting here thinking about how, 500 years from now, blaming Columbus for everything that's happened, it's going to be, I can see some malcontents 500 years from now saying, oh, it's Neil Armstrong's fault that we have the exploitation of space. I mean, it's not one person. It strikes me that what you said earlier on, if I'm understanding it correctly, is it's sort of there's an onward flow to events. I mean, Columbus did something pretty adventurous. But clearly, Columbus is not the reason North America got settled by Europeans.
Right. I think you're essentially right. And if you look at the history of Spain, you find one conquest after another. The Phoenicians and the Romans and the Visigoths and the Moors. And so the conquest by the Spanish of the New World was simply following in that tradition. The details of it are very interesting, and there are differences among all these conquests, but it was part of that context of conquest. We today, of course, have international laws against aggression of one country of another, especially of a larger country towards a smaller, weaker country. And so we sometimes impose our own moral judgments on the past like this.
Well, anyway, it's nice to hear the show, David. I do agree with your statement, but your Mr. Bull's statement that it definitely seems to be a very small number of people seem to be getting an awful lot of press attention on this, which actually raises a whole other topic. But why is bashing Columbus and then in essence bashing Western culture getting so much media attention? But again, that's not really specifically about this show. But thanks a lot, David.
Okay, thanks for the call. I hear what the caller says, and I think one can't deny the historical pattern that he identifies. I guess something that distresses me a little bit about that, and maybe it will distress other people, is somehow the implication that there is something sort of natural about one people dominating, killing, and enslaving another, and that that's that's sort of a social Darwinist kind
that's
of
right.
point of view.
Darwinian.
And that's there's something that makes me a little uncomfortable with the idea that that's just sort of a natural human activity, and we've seen it all through history. So maybe we shouldn't get too exercised about it.
Yeah. Well, we need that context too. We need a moral context also to evaluate history besides just looking at the facts of history. And we can look at this moral question in several different ways. One is to judge it by our own 20th century moral values. Another is to judge it by the moral values of the cultures that we're dealing with, which is a very difficult and complicated thing. Another is to say, well, there's an objective moral law that rules all people in all places at all times. Most people would subscribe to that view that murder is always wrong, no matter who did it. When Cain did it to Abel, it was murder and it was wrong. When the Indians murdered each other, it was murder, it was wrong. When the Spanish murdered the Indians, it was murder, it was wrong. However, we do have schools of thought, mainly coming from anthropology, that says that, well, if you murder within your culture, it's okay. And, of course, that had happened at University of Illinois Conference on Columbus just last week, where an anthropologist on a panel said it was okay to murder within the context of the culture because that was their values, and who are we to impose our values on them? And, of course, that raises the question, gee, if murder is okay within the culture of a context, what's wrong with the Nazis murdering people in World War II? And, of course, that just repels us. We do have to recognize that there is an objective moral law and that some things, like murder, are always wrong.
Let's go on. Someone else to talk with. Line number two. Hello.
Yeah, well, the social Darwinism of the last caller, it makes me more than uncomfortable. It's actually outrageous, and I think I'll have to identify myself as a Columbus basher. You haven't really had one yet. You said that Columbus had something to do with liberating the Mexicans from Aztec bloodthirsty rule, and that's you're actually doing what you're telling other people, the Columbus bashers are doing. Columbus is not the active agent of this whole domination of the New World by the Old, but he's certainly played a role in it, and I think has to be accounted for. So And he obviously had nothing to do with the Aztecs, as Cortes and Pizarro. And you obviously also, I'm not, again, in this cultural relativism argument you've just made, I'm not going to defend blood sacrifice, of human sacrifice, but I think you ascribed to the view that it was much, I mean, there is a revisionist view of this that says that it did exist, but it was much less dominant, much less present than Europeans in the past have said, and it has to do with an argument about physical anthropology, about how much they could have fed, how many people they could have fed, and the equation doesn't work. So people say, well, they had to have cannibalism, but there are other people who are saying that the Aztecs were aquaculturists and grew fish and algae in a very complicated system. And actually could feed a lot more people than they thought. So this whole equation about how many people they would have had to kill, that's a bit of minutia, but I think it's important to at least bring up, since you condemned the Aztec civilization out of hand as being the most bloodthirsty of ever. Something you said just recently that really hit a nerve with me is you made Christianity antithetical to bloodthirstiness, and that's just not true from the historical record. Christianity has been used many times. There are these people like Bartolomeo de Casos who, at the time of this outrage, were indeed outraged. So this idea that the morals of the time were not offended, it's just that the dominant historical record doesn't include him generally, though all native people certainly know about Bartolomé de Casos. You have some comments. I have something else specifically about Columbus that I'd like to ask you.
Well, I do have some other people, and we only have about 10 minutes left. So,
well, he did indeed exact gold tribute and cut natives' hands off if they didn't bring in the right amount of gold every month. That's in the historical record. And he was also put in jail for a year for some kind of malfeasance on his own part by the standard of the Spaniards themselves. So I mean, the record is certainly pretty fuzzy, wouldn't you say?
It is a very fuzzy record. Columbus was jailed because he was trying to control the Spanish who were massacring the Indians, and he was the lone Italian on his expedition, and he was also a commoner, and so the Spanish grandees who went with him resented his interference with their attempts to extort gold out of the Indians, and that's why he was overthrown and sent back on the ship in Spain. I did want to clear up that point about the Aztecs, though. Just as we want to recognize the massacres of the Spanish and others in the New World, we also need to accurately portray the historical record. And our best historians know that the Aztecs engaged in human sacrifice. Sometimes 2,000 people a day were sacrificed. Children's sacrifice was very common. They would eat, we think, most of these bodies afterwards at huge banquets. There was widespread cannibalism. Whole books have been written on this. Marvin Harris's Cannibals and Kings, for instance. Eric Wolfe's Sons of the Shaking Earth, where he said the Aztecs were the worst people in history for massacring people. So these are historians I'm quoting here now. And
I read Marvin Harris, and I don't recall the same kind of scale that you were referring to. And
better reread him. he's one of them, and that has emphasized the human sacrifice and cannibalism of the Aztecs. Among many other historians, in fact, it's a tiny minority in the field of history. It's certainly bigger in the field of anthropology that says that tries to play down the human sacrifice and cannibalism.
It's not a matter of playing down. That's a pejorative sort of line.
Well, that's what they're trying to do. They're diminishing the numbers, and some of them are even denying that.
And they're using this new evidence of how the diet was different and.
Well, that's speculative. Other people are using protein evidence that the Aztecs needed to eat people in order to have protein to support their population. That's a very controversial theory in history now. There's a lot of speculation going on about it. What we should do is look at the facts that we do know, the widespread human sacrifice and cannibalism under the Aztecs. The Mayas and the Incas, by the way, also did this. That's on the historical record. So it wasn't just them. The Iroquois did a certain amount of this, not as much. The Tupinamba Indians in Brazil did it. So it was very widespread among American Indians to do this. This is the old noble savage myth, another myth that has arisen through literature. That the Indians were perfect over here, and therefore they were innocent and shouldn't be conquered.
Well, that's reducing my argument entirely. I don't make that argument. I think that if you allow that the British could distorted the Spanish record, that you you certainly ought to at least leave the door open for the fact that we are trying to justify and ameliorate the massive indignity that's been done to the native and indigenous people of this hemisphere, and I really think that's your role. You didn't say anything about the point about Christianity. The implication in your tone was that Christianity is somehow antithetical to bloodthirstiness. As a theory, if certainly it isn't, it is antithetical, but that doesn't mean that's the way it's been practiced. I mean, I'll let someone else have a turn. Thanks.
Okay. First of all, we're not trying to justify the atrocities of any people in the New World. Certainly we owe a debt to the minority peoples that have been repressed and harmed in the New World, and we need to repent for that this year. The point about Christianity, of course, was with the Norsemen many of them stopped, most of them probably stopped being these bloodthirsty raiders once they were Christianized and were included in Europe as medieval civilized people. Certainly there were a lot of bloodthirsty Christians too.
We don't have a lot of time left. We do have several callers, and I want to try to include at least one, maybe two more people. Next up is the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, Ron Grossman wrote a book review of American 1492. Is Professor familiar with that book?
No.
Put out by the Newberry Library, and it commissioned scholars to write chapters on the rainbow of cultures that stretch from Alaska to the tip of South America. And in the foreword, it was stated that we have a problem here, it seems, that there are certain people that feel that there was nothing worthwhile in pre-Columbian America, and that there's others that try to portray America as a Garden of Eden peopled by happy, noble savages.
Yeah, those are the two extremes.
Exactly. And there's this new popular idea that Western civilization is the source of all of the world's evils, and therefore you get guys that a fellow by the name of Vinnie DeLauria Jr., who not only indicts Columbus, but even comes up with non-fake, fact-based statements that he wasn't really a very good explorer, that Celts, Phoenicians, Hebrews, Greeks, Romans, and other early Christians discovered America, which, of course, is nonsense.
You're correct.
But the thing is this, that the question of slavery, prior to Columbus setting sail, slavery was practiced by the Northwest Coast tribes, the Calusan tribes of Florida, and the Aztecs, amongst others. Let us be honest about this. I mean, it's somewhere in between these two ideas, and what disturbs me is the fact that Columbus is being judged in 1992 with 1992 standards for 500 years ago.
Exactly, and I think you're right. Your point about America getting bashed in this, too, that's the Marxist point of view, and unfortunately there is a very strong Marxist point of view in writing New World history.
I mean, I've heard it not only from the Native Americans, but you're getting the same idea that is by many black nationalists, that the only evil in the world is what Europeans have brought to the world in general, and that's nonsense.
Right.
There's good and evil in all cultures.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One more caller here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, David. This is Dr. Richards. I'm pleased to compliment everybody today. I'm very glad you didn't chop off that one caller and let him go on some more, because that enabled us to get more information out. I would say that it sounds to me like political correctness has gotten some correction today, and that's good. I would like to ask how one can correspond with our guest if he feels willing to give his professional address out. I'd like to take that down, and I would like to second the comments that somehow the media has been giving a great deal of attention to the Columbus slash America slash European bashing. Skipping over that, because I think it's been dealt with enough, I would like to ask the professor, does he have any information for us about which of the Native Americans in North America, Central America, or South America had invented the wheel by the time the Europeans were coming over here?
As far as I know, none of them had.
Uh-huh. That coincides with my memory from my grade school and high school.
You can contact me at Eastern Illinois University, the Journalism Department in Charleston, 61920. That's the Journalism Department at Eastern Illinois University.
We are almost out of time, but I want to try and squeeze one more person here. We'll go to line two. Hello.
Yes, I would like to tell the previous caller that actually the Olmecs invented the wheel long before Columbus came. You can see that if you go to Jalapa, Veracruz, in the Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology, but they used it only for toys. They made, for some reason, a very maybe conscious decision not to use the wheel like maybe other civilizations decided to use gunpowder, not to use it for weapons like the Chinese. So I think there's a lot of information that unfortunately did not filter in our education system, and we ride on misconceptions that make it sometimes very difficult to see the whole picture. I would like to make one statement, and that is in over the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico, there's a statement that says that all human needs are similar, only the resources are different, therefore the solutions are unique, but all cultures are equally valid. Thank you.
All right, I appreciate the comment. We're really pretty much at the point where we have to stop. Maybe we have, you know, can take another minute or so. Where do we end up in your mind on all of this? Where do you end up?
I want to say a good word for the Indians, first of all, since we've been talking about the other side. They do have a lot of values to give us. Their communal idea of land ownership, I think, is better than ours. Their closeness to nature, they have a lot to teach us on the environment. Of course, their food production and the variety of foods they gave us is just spectacular. So and a lot of other things you could say, that there was a very good side to the Indians, too. I would like to end up with a theme for the year, and to say that along with the repentance to make up for what we have done to the minorities in our past, the past 500 years. We also need, most of all, a theme of reconciliation, to bring our cultures and races and peoples together, not to be talking about killing each other, even though that may be more newsworthy because it's so sensational, but to be talking about making peace with each other and learning about each other and learning our history so that we can talk intelligently about this instead of getting suckered in by extremist viewpoints.
Well, I thank you very much for taking the time to come talk with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Our guest this morning, Pete Vols, is an associate professor of history and journalism at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston.